What's the job of a minister, really? To be in revolt against the bloody government. The Master. He had just turned off Whitehall and was a few yards from the door of the department. Normally, Davy looked about him, but the air was chill today, and all morning he'd felt deflated and tired. He turned the collar of his coat up, his chin was pressed to his chest, and he was barely aware of anyone around him. So the whack of a thick, meaty hand on his shoulder startled him. He looked up. The Secretary of State, his new boss, a socialist of the old school, was standing staring at him. He clearly just said something, but Davy hadn't caught it. He shrugged.
"Oh, dear Mr. Petrie, we don't seem ourselves this morning."
The man whom David had written off long before as a soggy mass of uncomprehending ambition leaned in towards him. His breath, very unusually these days, smelled of tobacco.
"We've seen through you, Mr. Petrie. You, old son, are not up to it. Your posh friends have done everything they can to pump you up, but the air keeps leaking out, doesn't it?"
The Secretary of State took his hand off Davy's coat, stepped back and looked in the direction of Big Ben.
"Grand, isn't it? What a place we work in. How lucky we are. But, you know, it's harder than it looks. An excellent digestive system and an ability to sleep like a baby, then a truly wily mind. And even all of those aren't enough to make a good minister. You were a local hero, I'm sure. The Nationalists certainly hate you. You've been picked up by the right, by the old lot, and they've done their best. But, matey, take it from one who knows. You are not quite good enough. My advice is to get out while you still can. Get back to your mountains and glens or whatever they are and build some more houses. Then at least when you retire you'll feel you've done some good."
He didn't like to admit it even to himself, but for his first few months as a minister, Davy felt out of his depth. Almost literally. The building that housed the department had been built in the 1970s and ignored ever since. Long, low-ceilinged rooms with strip lights and insufficient window space meant that even the ministerial offices were gloomy and crepuscular. It was like living underwater in a dirty lagoon. Apart from the ministers, the department was staffed by sullen young graduates who had struggled and borrowed their way to get into government service, hoping for the Treasury. They resented being shoved here, where they already knew they had failed in life. In the Treasury, they would have worn ties or smart skirts and blouses. Here, they wore ear studs and corduroy trousers. Inside the building, he was never alone. The government had taken on new powers over urban development, as over many other things. Arguments about the demolition of 1960s car parks, or the rerouting of traffic through housing estates, or the siting of new out-of-town supermarkets, which ought, he couldn't help thinking, to have been dealt with by the local authorities, ended up on Davy's desk. His office had three doors. One, at least, was always open, and he was sometimes approached from different directions at the same time. He grew to loathe the sight of his private secretary, a Wickhamist with tousled fair hair en route to the Treasury, arriving, smirking, with yet another fat folder. Nor did he have any control over his own diary. He was just allocated meetings. Meetings with backbenchers, meetings with groups of mayors, meetings with the trade press and the national press, and meetings with junior treasury ministers, who seemed to be able to take all the real decisions that he'd hoped to take himself. Another man might have been flattered. Davy was shrewd enough to see that he was simply being given the meetings the other ministers in the department recoiled from. But there was no one to complain to. The Secretary of State had not wanted him there in the first place. Apart from the stifling department, there were the Commons Committee meetings, the regular question-and-answer sessions in the chamber, and the mandatory lunches, provincial tours, and party events. Davy had always thought of himself as a physically strong man, but after a few months of being a junior minister, he felt as if he were on the ropes. He sagged in the chairs and lolled in the backs of cars. He found himself puffing in the street. He hardly had time to see Ella after his official car dropped him off at his flat. Utter exhaustion overtook him. Sitting with yet another red box, half-watching the late-night news, sometimes he remembered his regular telephone call to Mary and the boys. Sometimes he forgot. And, occasionally, he just couldn't be bothered. During all those first few weeks and months, there was no word from the master or Murdoch White or Sir Leslie Kahn. It seemed that he was on his own. How was he doing? He knew he hadn't screwed up badly yet, and his private secretary said he took decisions faster than his predecessor, which was apparently a good thing. He learned to throw himself into his paperwork, reading so fast he barely took anything in while looking out for the wavy line in pencil that indicated where a decision might have to be taken. It was as if he had been gently ushered onto a running machine that was going just a little faster than he could manage. Nothing he said or did seemed to be noticed anywhere else. If he had ever been in any kind of race with Caroline Phillips, he knew he was now falling far behind. She'd become a popular sofa guest on television discussion programs, and recently she seemed to be making waves with some big idea on corporate responsibility that Davy couldn't bring himself to try to understand. Being an adequate junior minister was, he realized, just another way of failing. Then, to rescue him, came a great crisis. The government was wallowing as the economy faltered and the Prime Minister failed to come up with a plan. Ahead of the budget, the polling was terrible and the troops were mutinous. In the end, it was the Chancellor of the Exchequer who came up with the big idea, a massive expansion of house building, including entire new towns to put an end to the growing agony of the housing crisis. The Chancellor spoke well. He sounded visionary. The commentators compared him to Attlee and Harold Macmillan. Some said that he might, after all, be a plausible replacement for the PM. And then, like a sprinting rugby player, the Chancellor passed the greasy ball in a blur to Davy's department. It would be their job, not his, to decide where all these new homes, roads and shopping malls would actually have to go. The hospital pass. And so, one cold, bright morning, there was a departmental meeting with the Secretary of State and all the ministers present, plus a dozen of the leading civil servants in the department for a strategic review. In politics, the master had said, strategic reviews are never strategic. They are always tactical and panicky. Nor are they reviews. They deal mostly with what has never been properly viewed in the first place. The country needed hundreds of thousands of new houses built, and everywhere there were vigorous local campaigns against horrid little boxes. Grandee journalists banded together to defend Oxfordshire. Actors and actresses spoke movingly of the delights of unspoiled East Anglia. Shropshire wasn't bloody having it. Rutland was revolting. Clearly the smack of firm government was needed. Some parts of the country were going to have to be upset, their objections ignored. Obviously, this being a Labour government, the idea was to find as many safe Conservative and Liberal Democrat seats to build over as possible. But it couldn't be too obvious. Some Labour areas were going to have to be offended too, otherwise the accusation of partisanship would be so serious that the crusade for housing would fail before it started. Even the useless young civil servants who would never make it to the Treasury understood that much. The Secretary of State was like a great slab of pudding, grey, unappetising, apparently passive. But he was as sly as he could be direct. He was tough, and he'd been fixing meetings since he was a teenager. He called on Davy as the urban planning man to open a meeting with some clear proposals. Davy, unforewarned, had absolutely nothing to say. He had wondered about suggesting a major new development in Barker, purely to irritate Caroline Phillips, but he couldn't quite bring himself to do it. His performance was terrible. Even his smirking private secretary looked upset. At the end of the meeting, the Secretary of State said,
"Well, I think we've made a little bit of progress. Not much, however, because, as we have all seen, our new colleague in urban development was rather lost for words. Mr. Petrie, I am genuinely surprised and upset. We had heard so much about your extraordinary prowess. Perhaps, after all, you're merely mortal like the rest of us. At any rate, I want to convene again at the same time next week. And by then, Mr. Petrie, we are all hoping for some answers from you. Good morning."
Davy slunk back towards his office. For once, all three of its doors were closed. When he walked in, he found no less a person than Sir Leslie Carnes sitting at his desk, his highly polished crocodile shoes crossed on top of a scramble of paperwork. He was fingering his beard.
"Ah, young Mr. Petrie, I thought I'd pop by. Used to work here myself a million years ago. Came in to congratulate you. The big meeting. Everyone's talking about it."
"A great chance for you, Mr. Petrie."
"Went well?" "Oh, no, it didn't go well, did it? I can tell by the slump of your shoulders and your rather convincing impression of a small dog that has just been beaten. Hmm?"
"It was a fucking disaster. They're setting me up." "I'm sorry, Leslie, Sir Leslie, but I didn't see it coming. I have to come up with a list of places for major new developments. Anywhere I propose, there's going to be a riot of protests and I'm going to be held responsible. I know I'm not an educated man, Sir Leslie, but I can see what's happening. They're throwing me to the wolves."
Leslie Carnes' face tightened and he rose to his feet.
"Never, ever say that. We have plans for you. But never, ever say that, or you will never see me or any of us again."
"Say what? Leslie, I mean Sir Leslie, it's the bloody truth."
"Never say I'm not an educated man. Nobody wants to hear that sort of whining. If you aren't educated, it's your own fault, and if you aren't educated, you aren't going to be able to lead this country at the highest level. You either start to educate yourself or you pretend to be educated. But you never, ever say you aren't educated. Do you promise me?"
Davy, stunned by the force of the attack, simply nodded.
"Good. Well, let's get on with it then. What are the basic requirements? 250,000 new homes. On cheap land, without causing a riot by the people who live there already. And somewhere close to jobs, somewhere people will actually want to live."
"Aye, broadly right. So it's completely impossible. We could stick them up in the islands, we the midges and the gnats, but hardly anyone would ever move there. We could stick them in Kent, but there's not enough of Kent left. We've used Kent up. And so on and so forth. The land in most of southern England is so expensive we simply couldn't buy enough of it. As I said, I'm being shafted."
"So you have a wonderful opportunity to confound your critics. Think laterally, Mr. Petrie. Close your eyes and think sideways. Think about the weather.
What?
Where is there plenty of land whose owners would be delighted to sell cheaply and where your new city would be in striking distance of the Midlands, and even of London?
Wales?
Don't be ridiculous. Nobody wants to live in Wales.
Well, I have no idea.
As I said, think about the weather. Winter after winter of lashing rain. Those chocolate-coloured floods. Those ruined farmers. Those ridiculous photo opportunities in newly bought Wellington boots.
You mean Somerset? The levels?
I do.
But with respect, Sir Leslie, that's completely mad. It's a floodplain. It's the one place we just can't build on. We said it ourselves, this department said no more building on floodplains. It's too dangerous, though no one's ever done it on this scale. And as for the insurance...
To David's disappointment, Khan appeared to have no quick-fire response. He just shrugged his shoulders, twiddled his beard and changed the subject.
You need a bit of a break. There is a big urban renewal conference about to start. Friends of mine, I've got your ticket already, and the department will pick up the bill.
Davy shook his head.
I've got no time for jaunts.
I'm disappointed. I've just said you have to start to educate yourself, Mr. Petrie. Well, here's an opportunity. And a little bird tells me that young Miss Ella James is available should you need an advisor out there.
That was more like it. Davy looked up and asked, Out where?
Venice.
The Education of David Petrie